Mrs. Thompson, Ms. Philbin,
may it please the court. My name is Lindsay Philbin, and I represent the petitioner Tanisha Carter. When Tanisha was 16 years old, on December 20th, 2000, she was put in the back of a Chicago police car and taken to Area 4, the Area 4 Chicago Police Station. She would remain there for the next 55 hours. She slept on a metal bench, no blanket, no pillows. She didn't have access to a shower or a change of clothes, and she was getting her period.
So, but wait a minute. I mean, as I understand the essence of your argument, it's that the state courts failed to take all of these circumstances into account, and especially with the overlay of her age, 16 and a half. But the state courts wrote some pretty long opinions, and they do talk about many of these factors, although not under the section of the opinion that you might have liked it under. But we've said many times, you know, our job isn't to grade the opinions of the state courts right. It's to make sure that the result that they reached meets the constitutional standard, the statutory AEDPA standards, as the Supreme Court has outlined them. So my biggest concern with your whole theory is that by the time you finished reading the state court opinion, isn't it pretty clear that they were aware of all of this and came to their conclusions in light of all of these facts?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it was. When you conclude that this confession was voluntary under these circumstances, had the state court correctly, reasonably performed the required analysis, they could not have reached the conclusion that this was a voluntary confession.
But doesn't she just sort of say, I mean, I realize it's 2 in the morning, doesn't she just kind of pop out with it as she's on her way to the restroom? I know she...
Your Honor, that is one of the errors in the state court decision. The state court, on page 30 of its decision, states she was not prompted by any questions from police. That's an example of how the state court didn't reasonably apply this test, the test that requires that you look at these circumstances.
Is that factually incorrect, or are you just saying that that doesn't take fully into account the circumstances?
I think the answer is both, because what happened was she was being escorted to the bathroom by a male police officer, 2 o'clock in the morning, second night in this interrogation room. She asks the police officer whether a man who she
Weeks,
had,
right?
Mr. Weeks, who she feared, the police knew she feared this man. She asked the police officer if he was still in the station. The police officer responded yes. And that's when the statement comes, after 35 hours in custody.
But it's not like Riordan says to her, well, would you like to tell me anything, or anything like that. She asks if Weeks is still there. Riordan apparently honestly says yes. And then she confesses, right? I mean, she confesses eventually 3 times, but she confesses.
And this is the reason that careful scrutiny is required for juveniles. And the Supreme Court has required that careful scrutiny for so long. Because what you need to do, what the state court failed to do, was to look at that circumstance through the eyes of a 16-year-old girl who had been in custody for 35 hours. They needed to look at the circumstance that way, not merely recite the fact of what happened. So
she eventually also confesses, does she not, that she and her boyfriend Hart were the ones who set the apartment on fire?
A variety of statements are made in between the 35 and 55 hours, because it isn't until 55 hours later that she's first told she can leave the police station. And what the voluntariness analysis requires is that we think about hour number 30, 16-year-old girl. Nobody's told her she can leave. In fact, they're bringing her dinner.
What about all these discussions, you know, with her father saying, no, I don't want her to come home, you know, it might be, or, you know, to my place, you know, maybe not home. So it seems that the fact that she stays at the police station is also one that one could view from a couple of different perspectives. And if that's the case, then don't we need to defer to the perspective adopted by the state court?
Not if the state court unreasonably applied the totality of circumstances test. That is, not if the state court failed to view the circumstances through Tanisha's eyes, through the eyes of a 16-year-old. Her biological...
Is that right? I'm not sure that that's a correct statement of law. I think the totality of the circumstances test at the end of the day is an objective test, so it would need to be qualified by the juvenile character of the person in question, that is to say, here, a somewhat older juvenile, but still juvenile. But I'm not sure it's subjectively Tanisha.
The way that the Supreme Court and this court has characterized the test is, and this is from Schneckloff, that the voluntariness test depends on the characteristics of the accused. And that's different, for example, from the custody analysis. So there is a difference. You need to look at these facts with the characteristics of the accused in mind. And in Haley versus Ohio, Justice Douglas talks really about the difficulty of that and the difficulty that judges are faced in trying to assess, in that case it was a 15-year-old boy who was questioned for 5 hours, in trying to assess how those circumstances impact a child or a youth differently than they impact an adult.
Well,
and that's where we failed here.
That's all true, we'll assume. But when you look at this 55-hour span, a lot of the time she's not being interrogated. She's with her father. I guess the sisters show up at some point. At some point, eventually, her mother comes, not till much later. She's playing with the typewriter. She's not just in some gulag-like room being hammered for 55 hours.
And these are characteristics that the state court adopted.
Did she ask to be released?
She did not ask to be released.
What I find disturbing in many of these cases is where the person says, I want to leave, I want to go home, and the police say, well, I want to go home, you have to talk to us, that sort of thing, right? But given the disordered situation out of which she comes to the police station, if that's as good a place as any, and she doesn't confess in response to a question, but it's spontaneous, all you're left with is her age, really.
I don't believe we're only left with her age. We also have the 35 hours, ultimately the 55 hours. We have the fact...
She's got to be somewhere during that time, and it's not obvious that she's more uncomfortable where she is than she would be. Where else would she be? I don't know. Where would she go what if they'd say, all right, we don't want to hold you, leave? Where does she go?
The police had picked her up.
Where does she go?
At her grandmother's home. From her grandmother's home.
She was afraid, right?
Is that the place with the woman with the knife, or is this a different place?
No, her grandmother's home was where they picked her up the first of the three times that they questioned her. But the problem, moreover, is this idea that she was free to roam around the police station, that she was free to walk out the door. She was a 16-year-old girl. She hadn't had extensive police experience.
Six times. That's why I keep saying it seems to be the only thing you have.
35 hours, and the Supreme Court in Haley noted that 5 hours of questioning would be difficult even for an adult man. 35 hours through the eyes of a 16-year-old. So it definitely is not only the 16 years old.
35 hours of questions?
35 hours of being kept within the four walls.
That's not 35 hours of questioning.
That's correct.
Well, how long was she questioned?
She was questioned off and on. We don't have an exact time period.
She had the polygraph in there,
yes,
somewhere that she flunked, whatever that means, obviously.
Well, she was told that it was deceptive.
Yeah.
But all of this goes really to the policy of why we have to analyze these circumstances, these situations, through the eyes of a youth. And JDB most recently talked about this. Justice Sotomayor relied on cases going back to 1948. But children, youth, teenagers, and adolescents all behave differently from adults. And that's where why a careful scrutiny of all of the circumstances.
A lot of immature adults and mature 16-year-olds. There's no bright line.
Ms. Philbin, could you address the Hardaway case, which seems to me one of your toughest obstacles here?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor. I see my time has expired, but I'll answer your question. There are two levels.
I always wait till the red lights go on, apparently. I'm sorry.
There are two levels of distinguishment for Hardaway. First, looking at all of the circumstances, this was a boy who had been arrested 19 times previous. That's one simple way to distinguish the facts here and the facts there. But in Hardaway, this court was able to find that the state court performed a searching review of the totality of the circumstances. No fair reading of the state court's opinion here, and in particular the three pages where it discusses the voluntariness of the confession, leads to a conclusion that there was a searching review or careful scrutiny. And the Supreme Court, the policy of the Supreme Court, the policy of this court has been that when a juvenile is involved, that's the level that a state court needs to engage in.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Philippin. Mr. Malema?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Eldon Malamuth, here today from the Illinois Attorney General's Office on behalf of Respondent Appellee. We ask that this court affirm the judgment of the district court denying the habeas petition because the state court reasonably rejected the claim that petitioner statements to the police were involuntary. There's no question in this case that the state court identified the right test. The only question is whether the court reasonably applied it. As your honors have brought up, there are a multiple of reasons to think that they did. If you take a look at the facts, some pertinent facts of the case, petitioner was a juvenile, but she wasn't 11 or 12. She was closer to 17. She was independent, living on her own.
Just admit that she's 16. I didn't think that part of the brief was. Heck, at that age, they're still sometimes saying, I'm 15 and a half, I'm 16, you know.
16 it is, Your 16 Honor.
16 it is, yes.
I won't go.
But here's the thing. I mean, your opponents, I happen to have found it on page 16 of their brief, point out that no matter how wordy the state appellate court may have been, when it was either laying out the background facts or discussing other issues, when they go to discuss the legality of the confession, there's just this little tiny excerpt. Doesn't contend she was physically abused. The record doesn't reflect that her will was overcome. She initially confessed while walking to the bathroom. The confession was volunteered, independent of any questions. End of discussion. So the concern here is whether the state court really was conflating too many things. Did it, in fact, make the factually specific assessment of the precise issue of the legality of the confession? As you well know, the tests on all these different things vary slightly.
Your Honor, the first thing that we need to do is take the court at its word. The court on page 31 states that states, quote, based on the totality of the circumstances, the manifest
way. We could all go out of business if that were true. And then what would you do as a lawyer or I as a judge? Because the state courts would just put that sentence in every opinion, and we would be relieved of the burden of all of these habeas cases because the states would just say, we took the totality of the circumstances into effect. You're not saying that alone is enough.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, that's exactly right. And it's not that I'm saying it. It's that this court and the United States Supreme Court has said that. Judgment affirmed, essentially, is all that's needed once AEDPA applies.
But you have to have a clue from the state court record. If it just says judgment affirmed, then what you have to do is go back and look at the lower court judgment to see if, let's say, the right legal standard was articulated. I'll take an easy one. Maybe the state court used the wrong legal standard, in which case that would be a contrary to kind of case, not an unreasonable application. So you need some tea leaves to figure out what was the state court doing before you can rationally apply the standards set forth in AEDPA.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I'll say in two parts. One is I'm not sure that's right. The state court at the trial court says motion denied. I've heard of the arguments. I've heard the arguments from both parties. Motion to suppress, denied.
And you'll look at the arguments of both parties. No, I think you're overreading whatever, you know, Penholster or, you know, all these cases that have been coming, Harrington against Richter. Why have a statute if there's nothing, if there's no substance at all to it?
Why have a statute which, why have AEDPA, which gives state courts, which lays out
which,
a certain standard of review?
Which provides a cause of action to state prisoners and then qualifies it with a demanding standard of review.
Well,
I mean, you're saying there's actually no cause of action.
Your Honor, of course, there's two separate issues here. One is what the state court needs to do in its opinion. All it would need to do, judgment affirmed, motion denied. Of course, if then you look to the facts and the case is there's no way to support those judgments, that's a separate thing.
The state court said, we don't follow Miranda in this jurisdiction. Well, that would be a contrary to.
Well,
I think what you're saying is the state court could say nothing.
Right, exactly. The state court can say nothing.
Wrestle with the facts.
That's exactly right.
And that's what I'm saying, too. Somewhere in the record, we have to see, have to have some way of figuring out what happened in the state court. Happily, the state courts don't usually do that. That's great. You know, I'm glad they don't. But
well, first of all, you're right, there has to be something. There has to be some. But whether that's
A brief filed by the state, maybe something.
Again, there's a look at the facts. In this case, luckily, we don't have to reach the issue of the outline case of there being nothing. In this case, there are a number of things. First of all, we can look to the opinion itself. It's true that the petitioners pointed to this one paragraph in the analysis and stated that's the analysis. But that's not exactly right. There's a opening paragraph which sets out the totality of the circumstances test. That page goes on to discuss the importance, the various factors, including age, intelligence, and so forth. The opinion then goes on to a couple times to repeat the importance of special care to be taken when it's a juvenile who has made the statement. Then the order, sets forth this the nut paragraph where its conclusion comes that the will hasn't been overborne and so forth. And it lists the most important facts. One, as this court has brought up, that there's no evidence of her will being overborne. There's no evidence the petitioner was asked a question. She's returning with an officer. The officer asks her if she would like a soda. He brings her one. And then she asks about this other individual who she has pointed the finger at, whether he's still in jail. She says, yes, he's in custody. And then she volunteers that she has committed.
She volunteered that.
Your Honor, I'm not going to put myself trying to elucidate a reason as to why people confess. There are plenty of reasons why people confess. In this case, she might have felt like her story was unraveling, and that once they questioned Weeks, they were going to find out that this wasn't the case, and that this had already happened in this case. She had told one story, for whatever reason, she changed her story, she changed it again. Perhaps she was moving on to the next story, which she felt maybe would have a better chance of standing up to any evidence that might be collected.
So you're suggesting the reason she asked about Weeks was that she figured if they had Weeks and they were talking to Weeks, then they'd realize that she was the murderer.
That's certainly one reasonable inference from the facts.
There's no discussion of that anywhere, is there?
No, there's no discussion of And there's no discussion of why she asked the question. That goes to another point of with respect to the petitioner's criticisms of the opinion, of the order, excuse me, that the order didn't address Weeks being in custody and how that affected her. Well, the truth of that is that petitioner didn't press that as an issue to the state court. So why would the state court focus on that in its analysis section? The petitioner focused on, laid out a couple facts, and then focused on the presence of her parents, the absence of her father, or the absence of her mother primarily, and at times the absence of her father. And so that's the factor that the state court spent the most time addressing. It looked at the cases. Petitioner put forward two cases primarily, Geo and Knox. The state court looked at those cases, distinguished those cases, and then went on to address the factors that it considered important. And there's also no question that the state court looked at, did set out a large background section, which must be taken into context. And it's, as the Supreme Court said in the early case, it would be it would not be right to assume that they were unaware of facts that they have taken.
They've just finished describing.
Right. Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. So the opinion, you know, might not be a perfect opinion, but it certainly reaches the test, satisfies the test, especially on AEDPA review. It's a complex decision. It's a totality test. There are a number of factors. They have to be weighed against each other. And if you look at the factors, especially the multiple Miranda warnings, the presence of a friendly adult, she was read her juvenile warnings multiple times. Taking all these factors into consideration, the judgment was reasonable. And for that reason, and for the reasons discussed in our briefs, we ask this court to affirm the judgment of the district court.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Malamuth. Ms. Philbin, your time ran out, but would you like a minute? Do you have anything further?
I would rather.
Okay.
Thank you. The respondent admits here at the end that the factors have to be weighed against each other. That didn't occur. And the respondent also talked about the most important facts being set forth at page 30 of the state court order. There is a factual error in that analysis. The state court says that the confession was made when Tanisha's father was present. That was not true, and you can find the correct fact at the supplemental appendix, page 10, and at page 10 of the appendix as well. Tanisha's father was not present when the confession was made, when the statement was made. Furthermore, respondent talks about this idea of Tanisha being concerned about her statement measuring up against physical evidence that might be collected. No physical evidence tied Tanisha to this crime. Her statement was absolutely the key in her conviction.
What about the letter from prison?
That was two years later, and it was a jailhouse letter to a woman, to an inmate with whom Tanisha was engaged in an intimate relationship.
There was nothing involuntary about it.
There are a lot of evidentiary issues concerning that letter that are not before this court, but the inmate in question was immediately released in exchange for providing information about this letter. But the physical evidence at the time, because that was 2 years later, the police didn't have anything. And in fact, after the statement, the supposedly voluntary statement, was elicited, Tanisha was released. That's the only time when she went home, when the police released her.
Okay. Thank you, Philip. Were you appointed or volunteer?
Your Honor, Baker and McKenzie has been pro bono counsel on this case since before the trial, since 2004.
Okay. Well, we thank you very much for your efforts on behalf of your client. And we thank Mr. Malamuth. Last case for argument, United States versus Sclina.